You are a prominent scholar of Freud. You are the general editor of the New Penguins Classics translations of Freud. But you have said it's a mistake to regard Freud as a scientist of human nature. Instead, we should approach him as a literary figure.
I'm interested in him as a writer. I don't want to say he isn't a scientist, because obviously he wanted to be a scientist and believed he was one, and he may well have been one. But I've always read him as a writer. And he's more interesting to me as a writer because there are so many other writers, it seems to me, that he's joining in a conversation with, a cultural conversation that begins in around the 1880s, let's say. And he's talking about the things that, you know, D.H. Lawrence is talking about, writing about. He's writing about the things that T.S. Eliot's writing about. He's writing about the things that Thomas Mann is talking about. In other words, that's the context in which, for me, he becomes interesting.
So why is that a more fruitful way to approach him as a writer rather than a scientist of the mind?
Well, I think Freud believed that we change ourselves by redescribing ourselves. And I think that Freud was part of a cultural conversation that was happening around the end of the century, in which clearly the world was very, the Western world at least, was very, very significantly changing. And of course, it was an amazing period for the sciences and the arts. I don't want to suggest this is one thing. And in a way, I think, it becomes more divisive to talk about science versus arts, because clearly they're complementary. And the scientists that Freud admired were very cultured men. And by culture, I simply mean they'd read lots of books. So in a sense, it's not that I want to make a sort of tendentious point. Freud is an artist at all. I just want to read Freud in a way that makes sense to me. And it seems to me Freud is really talking about how we want to live or what kind of creatures we are.
So are you saying that we should read Freud the same way we would read, I don't know, Kafka or,
yeah,
or
Henry James? Yes, absolutely. That really these, I mean, Freud says in the Studies in Hysteria, there's a moment where he says that words the effect of, I was shocked to realize when I read these case histories that they sounded like short stories. Now, I take that to be an interesting moment simply because the fact that Freud is shocked, he says, when they sound like short stories, they don't have what he calls the serious stamp of science. Now, in that is Freud's aspiration, I think, to a kind of cultural legitimacy through science. That's where the prestige is, if you like. And so Freud finds it very difficult to think he might be, as it were, doing creative writing. That is to say, he could be making it up. And the question is, what are these psychoanalytic sentences? Are they truths about life? In the sense, do they correspond with reality? Do they predict things? Are they accurate accounts of causes? Or are they actually closer to impressions and inventions and redescriptions?
When you talk about psychoanalytic sentences, can you give me some examples?
Well, the finding of an object is the refinding of an object. What I mean by that is that when Freud is read as a scientist, it's as though the books are read for the ideas. Well, books are made of sentences, not of ideas, I think. And that what I think Freud is doing under the cover of science is writing very, very interesting sentences about the human condition, let's say, or human nature. You can call it all sorts of things. But really he's talking about a very small group of people at the turn of the century in Vienna. But like all scientists of his period, he needs to generalize this and talk about man or human nature. But what it seems to me he's doing is he's trying to understand what people might be suffering from if you don't describe their suffering in the language of religion or in the language of conventional science.
It's interesting that you describe Freud as a writer of sentences because I've read some interviews with you and that's how you've described your own work too, as as someone who naturally gravitates to essays more than books and ultimately to the sentence itself.
Yes, and I think that's partly why I read him in that way, if you see what I mean. I think that it's not good to read Freud for the plot. It's not good to read Freud in order to be able to repeat in your own mind and to other people what his ideas are. It's much better to read Freud as an evocative writer. So that, in a sense, in reading Freud, like reading Henry James or even lots of people, your own thoughts are evoked. Because one of the most interesting things about psychoanalysis, I think, is that Freud is saying that knowledge, repeatable knowledge, is defensive. That we learn things in order to protect ourselves from the unpredictability of our own minds. So if you come out from a Freud essay knowing what he thought, there's a sense in which, in Freud's terms, you haven't read it. You haven't allowed it to work on you. Because what you've been so vigilantly attentive to remembering the ideas that you haven't allowed it to be evocative.
You're saying that there's that the unconscious is working on you as you read Freud.
Exactly.
It's not all explicitly there.
Yes. Freud is saying something absurd like, read with your unconscious. And everybody thinks, how do you do that? Well, in a way, you can't help but do that. But what you might do is try and protect yourself from doing that by becoming too grasping in terms of knowledge.
Now, I've heard some people say that actually a very close literary analogy to Freud is Sherlock Holmes, another detective of human nature, a brilliant deductionist, and also someone with a cocaine habit for a time. Do you see any parallels there?
Well, Freud, of course, was interested in Sherlock Holmes. I do. I mean, I think that one of the most interesting things about psychoanalysis is the analogies it produces. People are always trying to work out, including analysts, what psychoanalysts are like. Are they like doctors, like priests, like detectives? Well, in a way, they're like lots of these people. And I think one of the things they're like is detectives. That gives the romance to psychoanalysis, which is very important, that you're trying to work something out. But I think more interesting in psychoanalysis is not the working something out, but the experience of the gradual sense of actually not knowing yourself. That for me, Freud's saying something very paradoxical, which is that if we can know ourselves in a certain way, we will realize how little we can know ourselves. And that actually is the most important thing that we discover. Not in some glib Socratic way, I know what I don't know, but much more interestingly, the extent to which we by nature have a very limited sense of who we are and what we want and what we're doing.
Now, my sense of the range of criticisms of Freud, and Freud is—he's not the most popular guy these days anymore. He's had shinier moments in our culture, but I think one of the recurring criticism is he's just too sex obsessed. You know, he reduces everything to sex. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's a very interesting phrase, isn't it? Reducing everything to sex, as though sex itself is a reduced thing. I mean, I think in many ways he dignifies everything by talking about sex. I think the point is that Freud redescribed sex to include many, many more things than it had previously included. And I think what Freud is really saying is something like, we are bodily creatures who begin our lives by falling in love with a beautiful body, which is our mother's, if you see what I mean. So that we're naturally, in that sense, hedonistic. We survive through our pleasurable experience of other bodies. That then proliferates into all sorts of things. But by putting, I don't think Freud puts sex exactly in the center of the picture. He puts the erotic. And that means an erotic apprehension of reality. And what he means by that is, what makes staying alive alluring? You know, what's the desire that makes us go on doing it? And I think that's what Freud is interested in.
Parse that out for me a little bit. How is the erotic different from sex?
Well, the erotic is different because I think it's not a basic physical function to do with reproduction. It's much more about a way of seeing the world and seeing the world in terms of what gives pleasure and what gives fear and suffering. So it's a very fundamental bodily orientation to the world. And I think what Freud is trying to do is stay close to our bodily experience of what goes on between people. So when Freud's talking about the unconscious, he's very often talking, I think, about what passes between people without them realizing. In other words, we're exchanging words now, but clearly much more is being exchanged that we're unaware of. And that's why Freud talks about dream work. And dream work is something very, very interesting, which is this, that you and I may say interesting, meaningful things to each other here and now. But we might both go off, and tonight I might dream about your glasses, say. If I go to my analyst and we analyze this, it'll be amazing how much it can open up into both my past and the world of my present desires. In other words, Freud is saying it's as though there is an artist inside us who is perceiving things in spite of us. So the things we're consciously struck by are as nothing compared to the things we're unconsciously struck by. So Freud is very skeptical about the transmitting of information. He's saying there are all sorts of exchanges going on body to body that we're unaware of, but that we are actually digesting and metabolizing. And I think that's a better model than simply the idea that we're informing each other of things.
It strikes me that we as a culture still really haven't come to terms with the power of the unconscious. If anything, we're kind of more in the sway of reason, more than ever.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, everything to do with statistics, consumer satisfaction, the belief in science and neuroscience in particular. These are all old-style materialist causal accounts of who people really are. As though if one day somebody can actually explain how a brain works, we'll know everything. Well, knowing how a brain works is not going to help somebody whose child has just died, say. In other words, there's really a mismatch between the knowledge that we seem to be seeking as a culture and the knowledge we need in order to survive and live and, to some extent, flourish.
So there's sort of a fundamentalism of neuroscience, the idea that if you could just understand everything about the brain, that that would explain human nature?
Well, it's as though reality can make decisions for us, that if we can get the truth about the real world, we'll be relieved of choice. It's as though nature will begin to speak on her own behalf, whereas actually science is just what we sometimes have to include when we make decisions. It can't make decisions for us, because apart from anything else, we have to choose to value scientists.
It almost sounds like you're saying that we still haven't come to grips with how radical Freud was.
Oh, no. I really think, even though I know this sounds daft, that psychoanalysis has barely begun.
Really?
Actually. Oh, yeah.
I thought it had its heyday ago.
No, it did. It had a honeymoon period, and then it dawned on everybody this wasn't going to work. I mean, there's no way psychoanalysis is going to work in a culture that's committed to religion, science, and consumer confidence, because it doesn't meet any of those criteria. That's the great thing about it. So it's intrinsically countercultural. It actually is against the grain of all the things we're being sold, many of the things we're being sold. So that actually I think it was inevitable that psychoanalysis sort of died a death, and it's a great thing that it has in many ways. Because what this means now is there's no cultural prestige in psychoanalysis. No one will go into it for glamour or money. So people only go into it if they have a passion for it. And that will make it work again, because that's what it needed. It needed to lose its cultural charge and become really something that was obviously disproven. Freud's obviously a charlatan, and so we can just forget about it. And then only the people who are interested, it's like poetry, only the people who are interested in it will do it. And no one will go into it as a good career move.
So if psychoanalysis has been marginalized, you know, no one takes it seriously anymore, what are the insights that can emerge from it then?
Well, it's not the insights, it's the experience.
Oh, it's doing it.
And I think that people, psychoanalysts shouldn't be trying to make the case for psychoanalysis. It's silly. Basically, if somebody is either curious or desperate, they should go into psychoanalysis or read some and see if it works for them. You know, the idea that it's going to compete with knitting, aromatherapy, stamp collecting, etc., is absurd. It's clearly, psychoanalysis is for the people who find it amusing, interesting, enlightening, comforting, reassuring, stimulating. It's not for the people who find it fraudulent, misinformed, unscientific, and exploitative, obviously. It's almost as simple as that. So it's really the case for people who are curious or have tried everything else should give it a go and see what they think.
Hmm. You have been a psychoanalyst yourself, I mean, for a long time.
I'm one now.
Is there a certain personality type that works well in analysis? Or why does it work for some people and not for others?
Well, it's a bit like saying, you know, why do some people like white chocolate or dark chocolate? I mean, it's very hard to know that because obviously we are all very idiosyncratic. But certainly one of the most interesting things, I was originally trained as a child psychotherapist. In Britain, child psychotherapy was available in the health service, which meant that it was available to all classes. Now, I grew up in a world in which psychoanalysis was basically middle class preserve. What you discover when you do psychoanalysis with all sorts of people is that all sorts of people can use it. They really can. It doesn't mean it's for everybody, but it means that you can't predict for whom it will work. And that's another very interesting thing about it. So I've worked with people from very disparate classes, backgrounds, ages, generations, so on. And I don't remotely want to say it works for everyone, because it really doesn't. But for the people for whom it works, it really does work. And by that, I don't mean it cures them, because, you know, we're on Earth. There's no cure for that. But it can significantly improve the quality of people's lives by their own criteria. Some people.
I know you are now writing a biography of Sigmund Freud. Are there still things we don't understand about him?
Well, I think lives can always be re-described. You know, there are always things we don't understand about everybody. I don't think anybody needs a new biography of Freud any more than you need a biography of anybody. But I think there are ways of describing his life and ways of incorporating into his life all his own misgivings about biography that are themselves very interesting, because Freud really did not believe in biography. So I want to write a biography that includes his misgivings and reservations in the writing of the life.
The biography of Freud.
Exactly, something like that. That's one bit. And the other bit is something about the significance of him being effectively a first-generation educated Jew in Vienna at that period, coming from a very, very unpromising background, as of course loads of people of his generation did, and getting somewhere in his own way. So there's the romance and there's the heroic struggle. There's the fact that, of course, he was part of a culture. He wasn't actually an isolated genius any more than anybody is. Nor, you know, was he a great man. And, there are no great men. It's silly, all that talk. But what he was someone who had a real desire for something. He really couldn't stop working at something. And that's very interesting.
So are there lessons for other biographers, contemporary biographers, and as you look into the story of Freud himself?
I think there's more to be found out about those Middle European Jews, what it was like coming from Eastern Europe to Vienna then. Not simply the anti-Semitic story, but the Semitic story in a way, and what it was like for that generation of mostly boys who had access to education to suddenly acquire a culture that was so exciting to them and so alien. You know, in Freud's readings of Sophocles at the University in Vienna, I mean, this is really very extraordinary because two generations ago, his family were sort of very poor merchants, actually, in Central Europe. So that cultural shift, which, of course, lots of people, not only Jews, have undergone, it's a very interesting case study, I think, of that. Because one of the things you can see about psychoanalysis is it's Freud's attempt to understand his past. You know, the change in acculturation of those Jews of that generation.
Now, one thing you said about Freud is that he was radical in various ways. I mean, because he was questioning religion, he was questioning science, and you also said consumer culture. How so, consumer culture?
Well, I think Freud, I've recently written a book called Missing Out, which is a book about frustration. And the reason I wrote the book, I don't know the reason I wrote the book, but I wrote the book about the fact that Freud has very, very interesting things to say about frustration. Because although he doesn't say this, the implication of his work is that capitalism is really for children. In other words, it exploits the fact that children, of course, like adults, don't know what they want. Now, what Freud is saying, Freud's frustration story is very interesting. Freud says, when we are frustrated, we fantasize what we want. But, of course, you notice if you fantasize a meal, it doesn't nourish you. So at a certain point, you have to engage with reality. You have to get the meal you want. And what Freud says is we're actually very frightened of being frustrated. So whenever we're frustrated, we're prone, we're tempted to fill the gap very, very quickly. So the moment I feel a bit of unease, I buy something. I have a bath. I eat chocolate. I do whatever I do. What Freud is saying is we need to be able to bear with our frustration to be able to discover what it is we actually do want. Freud says a very interesting thing in A Letter to Fleece. He says, the reason that no adult is actually satisfied with money is because no child ever was. Children don't want money. And I think that's a very profound point. It's been said before, but it's a very profound point. Because children want affection, emotional contact, reliability, adventure, etc. And then they grow up into this world of capitalist exploitation, in which they discover there are a million things to want. In fact, we're living in a supermarket. It's great. But actually, it's terrible because it depends upon non-satisfaction. It's not that there is satisfaction, but there are degrees of satisfaction. And Freud is saying, and again, psychoanalysis might be one of the places one might do this, if one can learn to bear one's frustration, one will not be willing to be fobbed off by substitute gratifications. And consumer capitalism is a supermarket of substitute gratifications.
I'm trying to wrap my head around this idea of learning to bear frustration. What that means in
what that
in
would mean,
life.
Well, in a way, it's very simple because we've all had to do it every so often, which is it means that when you begin to feel that there's something lacking or missing or you're feeling some sort of hunger, you don't jump to conclusions about what it is that you were hungry for, because that's what the culture does. It jumps to conclusions for you. We're educated. Education and acculturation is being told what you want. Actually, it's extremely difficult to find out what it is one wants. So I might feel very, 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 very hungry at a certain point in the day, but actually I may want a conversation with a certain person. But it might be very difficult in a certain culture for me to get to know that.
So there might be all kinds of things that you want, but you don't actually recognize.
Exactly. You are unconscious of them. So Freud is saying it's not a culture, it's not a council of asceticism, it's a council of waiting. That if you can bear to wait, and if you can have certain kinds of conversation, you're more likely to discover more satisfying things for yourself. I think that's true.
So it sounds like part of your attraction to Freud is that he was a rebel. I mean, he didn't want to just buy into mainstream culture. And from what I've read about you, you have your own tendencies in that way, especially when it comes to technology. Now, I've heard that you don't use email. Is it true? You stay off the internet as well?
Yeah, I'll answer that. Can I go back to the first
one
first?
Yes, uh-huh.
The point about Freud is that he's a really intelligent hedonist. Most hedonists are not. Most hedonists are very, very moralistic and narrow-minded. But Freud is really trying to produce an intelligent, nuanced account of hedonism, of the way in which our lives are only worth living if we have the pleasures we need. In terms of myself, briefly, I'm not on the internet out of some protest, but I want less communication, not more. It's as simple as that. I really ideally only want to communicate with people that I actually know, insofar as I can. And other than that, I want to just do my work. I know this sounds noble, but it happens to be true. I don't want a large, I don't know what the word is, group. I don't want a too large group. And when I hear my friends telling me how they get up in the morning and have to deal with hundreds of emails before the day starts, that really is my idea of a nightmare, as in too much demand. And I want to protect myself from that.
And that goes for email as well?
Yeah.
I think this is actually relevant to our conversation about Freud because, I mean, to some degree, what you're talking about is the importance of relationships. And I think a lot of people would say in modern culture, especially younger people, is that using this new technology is intrinsic to the way people relate now. And it's not always face-to-face. It's, yeah. You know, there are different forms of relationship. But obviously that, for whatever reason, doesn't work for you.
Yes. I mean, I think collecting demands actually makes my life more difficult. But of course, what's happening is that people are changing. It's not that I'm saying I really think we should all do this. I'm aware of the fact that when I started not doing email, people would treat it as sort of cute. By now, they all say, you are so lucky. And that presumably means something, because I'm talking to a very small group of people. But really what's happening is that things are moving on. So the kind of things that I'm saying now will be obviously dead and forgotten very, very soon. And that's fine. But for me, I just don't want to do all that.
But it also sounds like what you want to do is you want to free up space in your own mind,
yeah,
at least.
Exactly.
In your life, to say, okay, I'm just not going to deal with that. And that leaves me more time, more, I don't know, mental space, creative energy to focus on the stuff that I care about.
Yes, exactly. And not find myself sort of getting recruited to meet demands that actually don't interest me.
I know you resist the temptation to try to apply Freud to how our culture could change, but if people took some of these ideas more seriously, if they took Freud more seriously, would society look a little differently in some places? I mean,
I think it would. I mean, my resistance is only that people have made very grandiose statements from a psychoanalytic point of view about culture or the West or the world. And I think it's absurd and silly, because actually people know very little bit of the world. But I do think, and obviously I wouldn't do the job I did, and I wouldn't be having this conversation if I didn't, I do think that Freud has a very interesting language to describe things that could matter to people. But I don't therefore think everyone should have psychoanalysis or everyone should read Freud. I just think if you happen to come across it and it engages you, you'll have thoughts that you wouldn't have had if you hadn't read it. And I think that's interesting. But it's really as good as what people can make of it. It's not good as a kind of idolatry. It's not good as a cult or a quasi-religion. It's very good as a stimulant or a prompt.
I want to pick up on one little thing that you said earlier. You're talking about dreams. I've come across the statements of some scientists who study dreams who say we shouldn't actually take anything seriously that happens in a dream. It's just sort of, I don't know, the brain firing in its own weird way. And, you know, it's kind of meaningless. It's just noise in the brain. You obviously think that's wrong.
Well, I like the fact that I live in a culture where people say things like that, because I think it's wonderful to render lots of things meaningless. I think it's quite interesting. But for me, it's not a question of whether it's true. It's a question of whether it's interesting and pleasurable. And for me, dreams are very, very intriguing. It seems to me amazing. Every night we produce these really, really very strange creations. It's like the thing Nietzsche said, you know, every man's an artist in their dreams. Well, in a way, they are. And so it's very interesting to find out what happens if you tell somebody a dream, what they say back to you. It can be a real conversation stopper. It can be the most boring thing on earth. But it can be very, very revealing. And I'm on the side of anything that keeps the conversation alive. And I think dreams, in psychoanalysis, really keep the conversation alive.
In the conversation, not just when you're talking with another person, but with yourself.
With yourself. It's the way you tell yourself secrets at night. And they're an amazing form of thinking, I think. But I don't mean that I think scientists who think they're nonsensical are wrong. They may be right. But I find them very, very interesting. I mean, it'd be a bit like saying, Wallace Stevens' poems are not true. And you sort of think, well, what does that mean? And clearly, they don't work for lots of people, which is a different point. But for some people, it's been very important in their lives. They've read Wallace Stevens' poems or listened to Bob Dylan's songs or whatever it is. But people find things in the cultural field that make their lives seem worth living. That's what culture's there for. It's to make us feel it's worth it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is fascinating. This is great. Thank you.
That was good.